You're listening to Face Off, Episode 19, recorded May 29th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we'd like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com or follow us at Twitter by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark, how's it going?
It's going good. How was your week? Anything new inside?
Good and busy. Keeping busy. How about yourself?
Yeah, busy.
So let's dig right into the news. There's kind of a big news item that was all over the internet. At Google I/O this week, they announced a new product called Google Wave.
Google Wave. So what is Google Wave?
It's kind of an odd product. It's like full featured instant messaging. Is the only way I can really describe it. They kind of call it like the missing link. They call it like communication. Like email and instant messaging, if they had done it right from the beginning.
If they were totally redone, this is the way it should be. Is that what they're saying?
That's what they're saying. What do you think of it from what you've seen?
I don't get, I guess, the context of it yet of how useful it would be.
Yeah.
But I guess we've seen the same as Twitter. When you first hear about Twitter, you're like, oh, what's the point of that? But so it might be very useful. I'm not sure.
I think it's good. I don't know. I think it's good and it's not good. It's a very impressive product. Always stuff from Google is always really cool. You know, I mean, you can't deny that.
It's not out yet. So
it's not. It's a private beta. If you went to I/O, they gave you keys, but the rest of the internet.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, the rest of the internet can has no idea really what it is, but. Based on like the video, we saw a big demonstration at a presentation at I/O. And there's some really cool things about it. First of all, the contextual spell checking.
Yeah, they did a demo with the spell checking, and not you know spell checking can do words, but like if you have their example is bean and B E E N or B E N, how do they say B E E N and B E A N, and then it knows based on where the word is in the sentence on which one you're trying to use.
Like it or, yeah, exactly. Like the best example was he misspelled Iceland and Ireland same way, and it was smart enough to know that the first time he's talking about Iceland, the country, and the second time he was talking about Ireland, the word.
Yeah.
So that looked really cool. I mean, it was really impressive. It has a huge database of conversations and word linking type things so that it can tell what the actual misspelling is. And that's great because...
Here's my thing is if they've had this spell checking all along, why don't they have it in like Google Docs?
That's a great question.
Do you think Wave, you know, made that part of it, or they're just using that as something they already had?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it seems like
because it's kind of out of
that
Wave's...
would be a big feature for something like Wave, just for one product. That would be a big feature for one team to just undertake for a product.
Right.
It almost seems like something they would be like, well, this would be really great to have, and Google, some other team might undertake it. I don't know for sure, but I agree. It should be in everything. It should be in Google Talk. It should be in Docs, it should be in Gmail, it should be in everything.
I agree. The search, it does a pretty good job of spell checking, actually.
Yeah.
Based on like users and what they're trying.
Yeah,
to...
it does a good job because it does sort of the same thing. It looks at similar misspelled searches or contextual words near it so that you know it's like, well, are you sure you don't mean this? Because you get in it does it in a smart way because it looks at like search results like, well, if you spell this word this way, you get, you know, four times as many results. I have a feeling that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
It's got really good asynchronicity. It's similar to a product like Etherpad that we talk about where you see edits happening as the person does them. It's not, you know, Google Docs is not very it's got a very delayed asynchronous action to it. Like you'll type and it takes, you know, sometimes 30 seconds or so before it shows up. This is like 100% real time. You know, just like Etherpad, you type and you see it happen.
Okay.
It's got good bot sort of things. Like some of the bots they showed was a Twitter bot, which is kind of cool, but they showed this really cool bot, which is a translation bot. So his friend's default language was French and his was English. So as he typed, this bot read what he wrote and translated it on the fly.
Yeah, I saw that.
Very cool. But all in all, I don't think it's going to be ridiculously revolutionary.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get the context of what it's going to be. I don't know.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's good technology. It looks like the spell checking and the stuff is really interesting, but... I don't know.
The funny thing is you see this demonstration and you hear them talk about it, you see how they did it. They talk about XML, and it's basically Etherpad, but it does some like rendering, parsing stuff on the front end. I mean, the technology behind Etherpad runs this. I don't know if it's the same technology, but the same sort of thing where it's like asynchronous text that is, you know, rendered on a front end. That's all it is. It's like embedding and stuff.
They also, another thing to mention is they have an API so the developers can, you know,
take it away. Of course, great. I mean, we like anything with an API. But all in all, I mean, some of the best Google products have taken existing things and made them useful. You know, search. There is stuff all over the internet. Google indexes it and makes it useful. Gmail. Everybody's using email already. Google gives you an interface that is intuitive and better. Instant messaging. Everyone's instant messaging already. Google makes it better. This is like a whole new product category. And I don't think the level of adoption is going to be super high. But on the plus, they're making it all open. Like an open platform. I mean,
that's always good. I like
that. We could create our own wave if we wanted to, which is cool. So, I mean, that might help it get over that sort of initial energy requirement of people adopting it, where if it's open and a company, let's say an enterprise company could put it as an enterprise application in their suite, then maybe it'll catch on. I don't know. It didn't hook me like it hooked the internet. I mean, the people at IO were clapping as he was making statements, and I was like, well, it's not really clapworthy. I just don't, you know, like, look, I embed this Google map into it, and when I change one thing on my map, it changes immediately on her screen. And I was like, cool.
So I guess we're going to have to wait until we can get our hands on it, I guess, to really put it to the test. Do you know when it's going to be released? Any kind of estimated time? Or?
No clue. No. I don't remember anything specific from the video, and the truth is I'm not like champing at the bit to give it a shot. I'm not super pumped about it. I don't think it's as exciting. It's a cool product. I mean, it's a cool, you know, it would be a web app that I would feature on the show and talk about how cool it is. I just don't know if it's as watershed as everyone kind of makes it sound like it is.
All right. Well, go ahead and check it out because it's news.
Yeah.
Something new.
Exactly.
Google produces some awesome stuff. So.
Yeah. Google. I mean.
It could be the next great thing.
Yeah, exactly. So check it out, Google Wave. Hopefully, you know, they'll open it up pretty soon and everyone can check it out. But all right, let's dig into the web apps, Mark.
All right, so the first one, this one looks really interesting, RunP. So
I found this one randomly, and so I go to movies with my wife. I can control my bladder, no problem, but she cannot. She gets up one or two times during a movie to use the restroom. And it's very frustrating because she really does not want to miss the movie.
Uh-huh.
And so it doesn't bother me because I have my soda and my popcorn and I don't have, you know, I can go like 3 hours without having to use the restroom, but she can't. So what this little web app does is it gives you gaps inside of a movie, which would be a good time to run and pee. So, you know, before the movie, let's say I want to go check out a movie. They have a list of, like, new movies by release date. So a new movie that just came out is Up. It's the new Pixar movie. So I look at it, and approximately 30 minutes into the movie, there's a gap where, you know, she can run and use the bathroom.
So with these gaps, are they're parts of the movie that are not as crucial, I guess? Or
yeah, exactly. I think they calculate with, you know, about a five-minute gap that – you know, if you come back, you're not going to miss something. Because you know the fear. Whenever you have to run to the bathroom during a movie, like you're like, okay, this looks like a good part. And you like run out and you come back in. There's like explosions. And you're like, no, what happened? And, you know, you come back and you're like, what happened? They're like, oh, he just killed that lady. It was crazy. And you're like, dang it.
Yeah, okay.
So,
and these look like, you know, theater movies, not something at home where you can hit pause.
No,
this is going to be in the theaters.
So yeah, new releases. So, like, you know, if you click on, you know, this one, it's, says about 30 minutes into the movie, there's a gap. I click on it, and it tells you what comes up on the screen. So, you know.
So you can know when it's coming.
Yeah.
You don't have to sit there with a watch or something.
It says, run pee approximately 30 minutes into the movie when the Doberman and the Bulldog appear out of the bushes. So you, like, you're waiting for that scene, and you see that happen, and you're like, okay, run, go.
Okay. I actually watched Terminator this weekend. And I'm reading the first one. It's about 50 minutes in, and I recognize the scene. And, yeah, it is. I mean, they just I don't know.
There's nothing happening there. I mean, it's not crucial.
It's not crucial at all.
So, and the funny part is, so they give you basically the easy way to recognize when to run pee, right? Like when the Doberman and the Bulldog appear out of the bushes. But if you want, you can also, because there may be a spoiler below, you can click, it's all scrambled, and you can click to unscramble it, and it'll give you more plot details so you know exactly when to go.
Okay.
So, like, on this one, I unscrabble, and it's like, it, you know, it says, like, so-and-so did this, so then, you know, so you know what scene
what
it is
missed.
Beforehand. But you also have the choice to not get a spoiler if you don't want to, because if you're looking at a time to run pee that's, you know, 75 minutes into the movie, it, you know, if they just spit this out here, it might ruin a chunk of the movie for you.
Okay, so I noticed there's a timeline bubble at the end of this the movie, and I was like, well, what? Why would they? What? Okay, so but actually, there's people that like to stay for the whole credits because sometimes they'll interject some scene or something in mid credit or at the end, and this is basically just saying, oh, there's no extra scene, so you can leave at the beginning of the credits.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't have to. I know in a lot of, especially like really good movies, you really enjoy the movie at the end. You're like, oh, I want to watch the whole thing just to make sure. Because sometimes they have an extra scene or something in the credits. But this is kind of nice. It says, yeah, you can take off.
Just go.
There's no other, other scenes, you know, or whatever. That's kind of cool.
So this is a way for people like my wife who have trouble sitting through a whole movie to sort of, you know, I mean, it's like and it gives you kind of the time of the movie. So you know, like, okay, well, about halfway through, I usually have to use the bathroom. So here's a gap, 45 minutes into the movie, I can go run real quick. And, you know, I'll just memorize kind of that little part of the movie where I can go pee if I just remember it, and I can run and use the restroom. So, go ahead.
I like the logo, how it's, you know, yellow color, and then all the text boxes are all yellow.
So, runpee.com, it's a way to go figure out when you can go to the bathroom in a movie in a theater. So the next web app we want to talk about is called tabloid.com, and it's with two Bs, tabloid.com. What Tabloid does is you insert a bunch of RSS feeds, one or many, it doesn't really matter, and you schedule a time for this service to send you a PDF of those RSS feeds of the new posts aggregated into a newspaper-like format that you can print.
Is that PDF then?
Yeah.
So this would be great if you had a Kindle
or one of those readers. Exactly. So,
because I don't think they do RSS, but the newest Kindle, I believe, does PDF.
Native PDF. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is great. What I did, some people, and we all kind of know that old media is dying, but some people just, and I'm one of them, I like to read things. I read a lot better if I have a physical piece of medium and I'm not staring at a computer screen.
I think a lot of people do. And I think the Kindle is kind of the medium point or the way around it, I guess now.
Yeah. We talked about this actually last week when we talked about the print friendly website.
Right.
I don't know if it's last week, but in a previous episode. And I mean, I just like to have something physical. I like to lay down, you know, something. And the Kindle is a nice half step, but this is a way that, you know, every morning, even if you don't print it, I mean, it's kind of made to be printed, but you don't have to.
No.
To get your news in sort of an easy to read format, like that's familiar, like a newspaper or a magazine.
Yeah, if you check out the PDF, it looks great. It looks like a newspaper. It's in three columns. It's got the date on the top and stuff. It's
images
really cool.
Embedded.
Yeah.
It's got titles. You know, it formats it, and it's
a little bit easier to read than like a Google Reader or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's a familiar format. Like I said, you know, we're all used to looking at, you know, a newspaper or a magazine, and it's, you know, puts your news in a format that seems natural to you. So.
And they also have no account required, which we always talk about. That's always awesome.
Yes. Oh, I'm so happy about that. Yeah. And the funny part is this is created by Hewlett Packard.
I noticed the logo there. I was like, what was up with that? Because it kind of seems out of place. But
yeah, exactly. So it's kind of odd. I think it's, you know, sort of like they're trying to add to their printing business because they do a lot of printers. So they say, well, don't read your news online. Read it. Print it on a piece of paper like you like. Comfortable.
It's very creative of them.
It is.
I guess that's a good point. I didn't think about that.
I mean, I've seen services like this, not one that sends you a PDF so you can print. And the truth was, I couldn't find them, so I was really excited about this. And then it's like it gets delivered to your and you put in your email address. You can tell it when you want it delivered. You can get a weekly issue, a daily issue.
That's nice.
You can say, you know, if you get weekly, you can say when you want it. So, like, let's say I just want to read all the news on Monday. You know, Monday's my RSS day. You know, I know that Monday is going to be, you know, I'm not going to get anything done anyway. So, let's catch up on all my RSS reading on Mondays, and it gets delivered to your inbox whenever you say in the morning, and then you can print it off and kick back and read your news.
You could have Procmail script that automatically prints it and has it ready for you to work.
Wow, that was... That's terrible.
It'd be digitally delivered to your printer.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm looking... It's kind of funny. I mean, you almost could create, like, a newsletter based off your blog. Like, I put in NixTutor, and I printed off a sample issue of what NixTutor would look like as a one of these things, and it looks just like almost like a magazine, like a newsletter article.
That's a good point. If somebody has they want to see your recent article or something, you can kind of print it off like that, and it looks a little bit more professional than if you were to just. Well, I guess what was that app again? The PDF
Print Friendly.
You could do that, but this looks pretty nice.
Yeah, it looks really good. I mean, Print Friendly. The whole point is to strip all the junk you don't want. And in a one article sort of way. This does it, kind of mixes it up and if you put different feeds in, it's kind of interspersed with content. It's not just one thing. So like they have a lot of popular feeds or a lot of categorized feeds, popular, tech feeds. So I could have we talk about this all the time. There's two kinds of RSS. There's like email RSS where I mark each one as read. I want to read and look at every article. And then there's a lot of websites like I'll cite them again, Engadget, Gizmodo that post so much. I don't want that style of RSS. I don't want to have to go through each one. I mark them all as read anyways. This is a way I could put like Engadget and Gizmodo, which would fit really well into this because they're two very similar topics, and get kind of just a quick glance look at all the stuff on there, because I don't read every article in a newspaper. That's the whole point. You could look at the headlines and gloss through it and see what you want, what you don't want. And this would be a way to, this kind of fits that sort of headline style RSS reading.
Also, if you wanted a digital version of this, we talked about an app called Instapaper earlier. An earlier episode where this is basically just a digital format of this.
Yeah.
Where you can read articles later.
Yeah. Yeah. They have different functions.
Yeah. Definitely. But,
Tabloid.com, 2 B's. What 1 B is not the right URL, we found out. I mistyped it earlier, and we were trying to figure out what I did wrong. So, what do we got next, Mark?
The next one is Repper by, let's see, Repper Studio
Lens? By Studio Lens, yeah.
Studio Lens.
This is just a really small little web app that's really cool. What it does is you upload a photo or something and use the sort of selection box in it to create a repeating pattern.
Okay.
So, and the cool part is you can use your own picture or you can just select a random image and then you kind of take the square. There's like this little selection square that you can resize and move around, and it creates this sort of patterned wallpaper tiled background for you.
I didn't notice this, but the second time going to this page, the background changed. So they've got some. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think so when you create images, it kind of goes into a pool that will change the background for you on the website.
So you can basically upload any image and then put your square over it, and then it just makes some sort of background abstract.
I mean, it literally just takes the selected square and tiles it. But it's funny. You can create some pretty cool patterns off normal images, like. A lot of the images they have are aerial maps, and I mean, you can create some really cool patterns off of it, and some of them look really abstract, or you can select a spot and make it purposely, noticeable. Like one, it was a picture of a street with like a yellow taxi cab on it, and I centered it so the taxi cab was part and was obviously part of the pattern, and it looked really cool. So, I mean, this is a simple way to, you could do this really easily in an image editor, but it would take a lot more work because you'd have to select the part you want and then paste it into another one and paste it and tile it yourself. Where this is just a quick way you can kind of, touch it a little bit there and see how that affects the overall wallpapering pattern.
Okay.
So, I was thinking, if you want just a quick tiled background that's really unique, you can use it and it'll be fast.
Yeah, it looks great.
So that is Repper by Studio Lens. All right, Mark, what do we got for our first topic this episode?
The next one is top 10 things that annoy programmers.
All right. So this comes from Kevin Pang's blog. It's just a list of things that annoy programmers. So what's the first one we got, Mark?
First one is comments that explain the how but not the why.
Yeah. This happens a lot, and this is the first time I've really thought about it like that. I mean, after I read this article anyways, and it makes sense. A lot of times you do like some crazy math or some crazy logic. And if you do write a comment, and again, you're lucky if you get a programmer that comments it, they'll say, I'm doing this complex math equation, but you don't really get the background as to why you're doing this, you know, and that can be really helpful because a lot of times the whole point of a comment is if you're transitioning in new personnel, you know, or you have other programs looking at it who don't know the history of the project or all the politics that went into making this decision, like, why are you doing this complex math? Why, you know, okay, I see that you're doing this equation that does this crazy stuff, but why? What is the purpose?
Right. And in this one, it says like R equals N divided by 2. And then it says R is N divided by 2 is comment. You can kind of see that by the code.
Yeah, exactly.
You should, you know, say I am dividing 2 because we need this number to aggregate this or whatever
exactly.
It does.
Exactly.
We like the Y.
Because there is duplicate entries in this list. So the total number of entries is that divided by 2. Oh, that, I mean.
Then, yeah, okay.
Now you know why. I mean, it's like, oh, okay. So instead of being like, okay, so this guy's dividing the whole list by 2. That is obviously wrong.
That's a good, you know, I think I'm the kind of guy that just says, I'm dividing this by 2. And
I'm a
that's
how.
All I say. I'm
yeah.
the how.
Yeah, I'm a how, definitely. And it's a good thing to think about. Give the why. I mean, we all hope that we have enough good documentation and communication that we know about, you know, why decisions were being made and why they weren't, but often not. And this is the best place to do it.
Yeah, instead of saying like, connect to the database and select users that are this or whatever, you could say, we need to get all the users because we need to populate this list or whatever.
Because, I mean, yeah. It's almost you could say to yourself, because, you know, after your comment, always append a because and does it fit, you know? Yeah. Like, give the how and then because we need to make sure that we have half the number because, you know.
Because we need to validate user input so we don't have SQL
exactly.
injection or something.
Exactly.
Instead of saying, we are stripping out all digital characters from this.
Yeah, and you're like, okay, well, you know, or the other one is like, okay, well, I notice you're stripping characters, but you're not stripping them all. You know, you're like, okay,
right.
we're sanitizing validation. Well, I mean, you might say, you know, specifically we're trying to parse out HTML tags or, you know.
Instead of saying we are stripping out digits, hyphens, this and that, you could say we are stripping out characters because we are trying to whitelist. Well, I don't know.
Or even this one, the example he gave in there is that instead of saying, you know, set R to N divided by 2, it's we're finding the square root of N with the Newton Raphson approximation. Okay, that's so instead of just an equation, now you have an algorithm or a method that you can look up. It's, you know, it's just smart commenting instead of, like you said, it's very obvious. I'm dividing it by 2. That makes sense. But why? How? What is the purpose? You know, good commenting is important because we all seem to think that we're the only ones that are ever going to work on something. And, you know, your organization deserves to, if you're going to call yourself a coding professional, you need to do it professionally. There are standards. And, I mean, good comments is a standard, and a lot of people don't follow it.
Okay. So the next one we got is interruptions. And I am a big, like, if you interrupt me, there's no point in programming if I'm going to get interrupted.
Mm.
For me, that's just the way.
Yeah.
For me, it takes at least a half hour or so to get in the mode or the, you know, the mindset of programming and get in there and really start going at it.
Yeah.
And if I get interrupted, it's like starting from zero again.
Yeah. The analogy he uses in the article is programmers tend to be more like locomotives than Ferraris. It takes us a while to get going, but once we do, we're going to chug along pretty well.
Yeah.
And that I think that's true too. I noticed that. I mean, when I start getting productive, it snowballs. I keep going.
Yep.
Get pumped and. You know, a slight interruption can really interrupt that whole mindset of like, okay, no, I'm going to keep going. I'm getting pumped. And then, you know, you get someone chats with you online or someone chats with you in person and your mind gets taken off it and it takes you that much longer to get back to where you were.
Yeah. It's like you're in the code and you're like in the code, literally. Like you're thinking about it. And then somebody says something, and then you got to go back and think about where you were. And then once you find out where you were, you got to think to yourself, well, why was I doing this? I can't remember now. And
yeah, exactly.
You got to kind of start over.
Yeah. It's tough. So try not to interrupt your programmers. Let them get in the zone and let them get rolling. Number 8 is scope creep. And this isn't just a programming problem. I mean, this is an everywhere problem. I've seen it where I work multiple times. It's a really hard thing to defend against because you don't want to take so much amount of time sort of preparing the requirements analysis and everything like that, that, I mean, you could make an ironclad scope document, but that takes a lot of time. And so I notice a lot of project management methodologies are almost put in place to kind of try and deal with that. Like I'm learning a lot of agile stuff right now, like Scrum, and it's kind of put in place to protect the team from getting too much scope creep, because it almost says functionally that you can creep the scope if you want, but it limits the person to say, I have X amount of time to work on it. You can't just keep throwing stuff on and expect them all done in a month.
Okay.
But it's a really tough problem. I mean, you want to take the time to get, like, you know, a really good scope document ready so that everyone has the exact same expectations as to what the end product will be. But at the same time, if you spend too much time on that, and then what if the project doesn't get picked up? Oh, great. Well, we just spent 5 days working on an ironclad scope document, and now we're not going to even do the project.
Yeah, I've seen this a lot. I've seen this happen a lot in some of the projects that I've done, where you start off, they say, I want this and this, and you start working on it, and then they say, no, I want this, you know, and then it starts creeping, and then it says, well, how hard would it be to add this, and how hard would it be to add this, and you know, when you originally gave them a quote or whatever, you said, this is, it's going to take them probably about this many hours, and then you start adding this stuff, and then it's becoming more and more and more hours, and it just becomes a big mess. And
it's really tough if you're doing sort of contract programming, where you give sort of a bid or an estimate up front, and I mean, the hard part is they have to realize that an estimate is an estimate. But it's also hard to communicate that, you know, because you're adding stuff, it's costing me time. So, you know, like when I worked at one place where we did some programming, and we didn't estimate it. I mean, we pretty much gave them a bid, like, this is how much it's going to cost. And they would say, okay. And then it was really intense, and it's sort of the project manager's job, whoever. I mean, a lot of programmers are the project manager as well, which is bad, but it's that person's job to say, no, you know, I know the scope, this is not what we talked about, I'm gonna have to change the estimate if you want this added,
right?
And they call it creep because it's dirty, it's little things you're like, oh, add this, and then by the end of the project you look at it and you're like, well, that doubled the amount of work on the project.
And I think part of the reason it annoys programmers is that code just becomes messy when you start creeping and adding features that you didn't plan on at the beginning.
Yeah. Because, exactly.
I mean, just the way, if you're not a programmer, you might not understand it, but basically it's hard to go back. I mean, you basically have to rewrite it if something major, otherwise it just becomes messy, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, one way to sort of help with scope creep that we talked about in the past is test-driven development. So one way you can think of it, if you're writing good tests, that is almost a scope document. You're saying, especially if you use stuff like user stories, like a normal user can log in, a normal user can view their stuff, a normal user can edit their stuff. When they're like, all of a sudden they're like, well, I want people to be able to upload pictures too. And you're like, well, that's not in the user stories. I mean, if you get your customer or whoever to sign off on your tests for your user stories for tests, then you're almost signing off on, this is the functionality. And if it's not in those tests, then you say, no, that's extra stuff and it's going to cost you money. So the next thing on the list is management that doesn't understand programming. You know, the honest truth is I haven't really ran into this a whole lot, but I can see how it would definitely be a problem.
Yeah, I could see this where it's like, well, how long does it take to implement this feature? I thought it would only take, you know, 5 minutes or whatever, and it's a really complicated programming, you know, problem.
Yeah, exactly. So the cartoon that they have on there is an XKCD cartoon where it's like, the number one programmer excuse for legitimately slacking off, my code is compiling. And it's like these guys that are sword fighting, and it's like, what are you doing? And they're like, we're compiling. And he's like, oh, okay.
I remember seeing this cartoon. There were some other ones too for like video guys, whatever. And there's was rendering.
Yeah, exactly.
They're rendering, and these guys are compiling.
Yeah, and again, is management not understanding it. It can go either way. Either your management just accepts everything you say ironclad, and sometimes, I mean, you have to admit, sometimes we all slack off, and you need your managers to keep you on your toes, to keep you productive, keep the team rolling, you know, keep energy high. And then there's other times where it's the exact opposite, where they don't trust you or don't believe you at all, and they think you're almost lying all the time. Like, well, compiling can't take that long. And you're like, well, you don't really understand what compiling is, because it's kind of a big deal. Or video rendering, you know. I mean, video rendering intense
stuff.
Takes
forever.
Yeah.
And what do you do when it's rendering?
Yeah. I mean, you can't use your computer. It's using, like, it's, you know, so it's tough. My problem, it's not even a problem. It's that programmers can sort of lessen this a problem by doing things like not using buzzwords so much. I'm terrible about this. I'm always using all kinds of, you know, buzzwords and acronyms and things like that. And sometimes, you know, I do it and it gets me into trouble because I'll just kind of like spit off like, yeah, you know, we're sending a JSON object through a RESTful API. And then, my, you know, the boss will be like, what is this JSON thing? You know, it's like, well, if you just said like a data blob into a, you know, a usable interface, okay, that's, you know, that's different. That's basically what you're doing.
It's not a buzzword anyways.
Yeah. And it just, it doesn't make you sound as smart, which is the problem sometimes with these things. So it's a give and take both ways. Hopefully you have a good enough manager that will try and understand you and what you're doing, and also be mindful that, you know, you can help your superiors understand and do it as well.
The next one we have here is documenting our applications. I don't know. What is it? Programmers just hate documenting things.
They absolutely hate it. It's tough.
They did all that work, and then they got to go back and basically write, like, read through it again and write out how it works. And
yeah.
Programmers like to solve problems. They don't like to document the solution.
Well, the funny part is a huge problem is that we don't know what the heck is going on because no one's documenting anything, but they don't want to solve that problem, do they?
Yeah, I understand it, but it's just they just don't like doing it. But
yeah.
If they've got to work on that project a year later, they're going to wish they had documentation.
Yeah, and I think this is something that happens the more mature you get, the more programming you do. A good way to do it is to look at someone else's code that isn't documented, and you're just like, oh, this is terrible. And then you're like, oh, that's the whole point of that documenting thing.
Maybe is if you had tests that went along with your program, that might help.
Yeah, tests kind of help documentation. I mean, there's all kinds of things that create nice-looking documentation, but at the core, what the article kind of talks about is that there are things that make good API documentation, which makes sense. Like, you know, this API docs, you know, this method takes a integer. Okay, that's useful for programmers. But the hard part is things like user documentation.
Screenshots,
technical documentation. And it's hard to get people to do that because the funny thing is the line at the end of the article is, I think I can safely speak on behalf of all programmers ever when I say, can't someone else do it? And that's the problem is, I mean, imagine who wants to get hired to just do documentation. I mean, so what? Should we just shove it to like the low-level programmers, the new guys? No, they'll never get any useful programming out of that. So it's just if everyone does their part and does a chunk of it, and there's a lot of good collaboration tools out there now to make it a lot easier to do.
And nobody knows the documentation better than the person that wrote the program. So
yeah, exactly. So I mean, yeah, exactly. If someone else does it, they have to learn the program, write the documentation, and it should just be a good iterative cycle that everyone does. Again, if you're a programmer, it's time to be professional. Programmers, it's funny, they want to be treated like professionals, but at the same time, they really, some of them act like children about some of the most trivial professional things. And this is a professional thing you need to do. You should be doing things like test-driven development. You definitely need to document your code. You need to document it right. You need to use things like, you know, version control. It's just be a professional. I mean, just being able to program does not make you professional.
Next one we have here is applications without documentation. Can we just talk
well,
about
no,
that?
Well, no, it says, you know, the first one is they don't want to document their applications, but programmers hate applications without documentation.
Gotcha.
So it said, you know, I never said that we weren't hypocrites. Programmers hate applications without documentation. And that totally makes sense.
Yeah, you're like, okay, I got to integrate with this API, and this function is not documented.
Yep.
Like, oh, when we were working on NixTutor originally, we were looking through WordPress tags.
Yep.
And I don't remember the exact tag, but it wasn't documented at all. But we knew the tag existed, and we kind of knew how it worked.
Yeah. It's like you search the internet, and there's so many WordPress tags out there, but like only half of them are documented. And it's like, oh, it's so annoying. But again, yeah, I'm a prime offender. But then again, I've never, ever, ever, ever claimed to be a professional programmer. So it's okay. I don't have to hold myself to these standards. But yeah, you need to document, and the better you get at it, the better it helps everyone out. So I think it should be mandated. All right. So the next one is hardware, and this is so true, especially when it comes to Linux. I like it. I like software. I like working in existing systems that work fluidly. Things like WordPress. That's why I love WordPress. WordPress works great, so I want to play with it. I hate in Linux when I can't get my hardware to work. I don't want to. Some people, hardware guys, they love like digging into the stuff and seeing the signals that are being sent, and making drivers and looking at IRQ settings. And I absolutely hate that. If my stuff doesn't work, I don't even want to play with it. Like,
I think the biggest thing is the programmers have enough to worry about to get their programs to work and without having to worry about hardware issues.
Yeah,
exactly. It's annoying.
Yeah, and it's like you just want it to work. I mean, I think that's why programmers tend to be so picky about like their computers and stuff like this, because we spend so much time getting it exactly how we want. I mean, you and I, we tweak our VimRC and our BashRC to hell and back. And I just don't want that sort of stuff to change. And, I had a friend who, the thought of reformatting his computer was pretty much asking him to cut a finger off. I mean, it just scared him. It scared him.
See, I'm like, I know I'm going to have to format, so I'm going to prepare for it.
Exactly. I'm the same way. I mean, I keep everything on offsite storage, Dropbox or on Adrobo.
I can pretty much format within, an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Of moving some stuff around.
I tend to, I manipulate my workflow so that I don't have to use things like, I don't like plugins for software. I don't like, I don't like fancy keyboards because I don't want to get used to a feature of a keyboard that isn't on every single keyboard out there.
I agree. That's part of the reason I use Vim is because almost every server, every computer has some version of Vi or Vim.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, like I was joking around, we say we tweak our BashRC and our VimRC, but I really only have like three tweaks in my VimRC file because...
Yeah, I have like four lines.
It's like things that I can remember if I have to. So if I hop on someone else's server and I'm like, oh God, I need my syntax highlighting, I can go in the VimRC and change it in 2 seconds, but I only have four lines that I need to do.
Okay, here's a good example is a lot of people remap like caps lock to escape, and I was thinking about doing that. I was like, but if I... go on to another computer, another server, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be a big pain.
You're going to be hitting caps lock. Think about that. Especially, you're going to be hitting caps lock. Ugh.
So what I did is instead, you can hit escape by doing control in the left bracket. Mm-hmm. And at first, I was like, man, that is a big pain. That's harder to do than hitting escape, reaching up all the way to hit the escape where it normally would be.
Yeah.
I actually finally got used to it only after about 3 weeks of practicing it. I that's just what I do now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So
now I can be vanilla. I don't have to remap things.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I have this buddy at work, Ben, and he loves things like Emacs plugins and Vim plugins, and he loves plugins and special software and everything like that. And it makes me just queasy thinking about it because I can't handle it. And he loves it, but for that reason, I think it's because I've had to do sort of spot reformat so much. He's really smart about. He does what we do, keeping it offsite and stuff, but on a massive scale. He's a really big Linux guy, so he has no problem doing that. Uh-huh. Whereas when I was really, first started Linux and stuff, I didn't know anything about it. So when I had to do a couple of spot reformats, I was really mad that I didn't have all my plugins and all the stuff that I had saved. So I adjusted my workflow so that, again, like you said, I can be vanilla. Exactly. You go through the pain of learning like a new keyboard shortcut, but then you're like, okay, well, you know what? I don't need that special button on my mouse to do something now. I can go to any mouse and I can use it without having to be frustrated because I hate that frustration of not having something that I'm used to having. So that's why I get used to normal things.
If only everything used the Vim shortcuts, though. I find myself like, I'll be doing Vim, doing coding for like 3 hours, and I'll switch like my email, and I'll be like, JK, what's going on?
Yeah.
But yeah, sticking with vanilla is definitely the way to go. It makes your life easier for me anyways.
It's the way to go for us. Some people just turn it that way. There are some really cool stuff that isn't vanilla. I mean, I tried a plugin for Vim once called NerdTree. And I love it. It's a great, especially if you're doing something like MVC stuff with like Rails, it's a great way to browse through folders. But then when I switched to another computer and it didn't have it, I was really, really mad at myself because I didn't have it. And I just get frustrated by it easily. But Wow, that was hardware. That whole discussion was about the topic of hardware, and it had absolutely nothing to do with hardware.
Well,
okay. So
the next one is vagueness.
Yes. Oh my goodness. I tell you what. Yeah. So, it has to do with support mainly. So I've been doing support for this rollout we had at Montana State, and you would not believe some of the vague emails that you get. I mean, just people are like, "It's not working."
What?
And you're like,
is not
"What
working?
Is not working? What?
My email." What part of your email?
Outlet yeah, I mean, can you even or... log in? I don't. You need to tell me something. Don't. I mean, and I had one. It was really funny. It was like, and in their defense, the person actually apologized after this. They said, "It isn't working. This is a waste of my time." So I replied, I was like, "Well, actually, sending vague support email address also wastes my time. So why don't you send me back some detail of what you're having trouble with, and I'll try and help you." And the person sent an email back. They apologized. But you just don't think about stuff like that. I mean, people are mad because you do something that they feel like is wasting their time. But by doing vague support requests, you're wasting my time, too. My time's just as valuable as yours.
Another thing, too, is they'll say something like, you know, "We want this feature." And you're like, "Well, wait, what exactly do you want?"
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they don't think like a programmers are precise. Exact, like, so.
Well, because we're thinking of precisely what we have to do to implement it,
right?
And with the other thing that we hate is implementing something and then having it reverted later, because nothing makes you more mad than having to work hard on something and have someone be like, nah, I don't think I like that. And you're like, what do you mean? No, I can't just undo these hours of my life that you wasted having me do this thing you don't want.
Yeah.
All right, so what do we got next? Other programmers is the number two. Yeah, programmers don't always get along with other programmers. I mean, the reason you and I started this podcast was because when we first started talking about programming together, we had some major, what we thought at the time, major differences in how we did things. What we found out is through exploring each other, you know, exploring each other's methods later, that we actually really liked the way each other did stuff and kind of came to our own best practices. But at the time, I mean, we were like, I think it was, I was just starting to learn Ruby and Rails, and I was like, yeah, and you were like, no, that is like the biggest hipster thing in the world, you know, it's all Mac users and stuff like that, you know, and you, I think you're like, I want to learn Perl, and we had little arguments about that, and programmers cannot get along sometimes. It's crazy.
If I had to work with somebody that primarily used Dreamweaver and they were like messing up my SVN, the subversion server, and just,
absolutely.
I would go nuts.
Exactly. I agree.
I was working with a guy that, his Dreamweaver would like lock files or something, and then you'd change it, and then all your changes are gone. And it was like, that is the point of SVN, so it doesn't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Fix your program.
Or, I mean, I've gotten in arguments at work with like hard versus soft ads. I mean, there's just, programmers argue about a lot of things. First of all, we learn like one language, and I mean, we become usually very proficient in at least one language. And that's what we like. We picked it for whatever reason. It may have changed after using it for 5 years. We don't really care. But all we know is everything else sucks. I mean, everything else is...
You know that way that one works.
Exactly. And so, I mean, you have to be open-minded sometimes. And like...
We're like, yeah, tabs versus space is a good one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hard versus soft tabs. You're like...
It was the Dreamweaver guy, actually. He had... the character returns were all messed up. And I work in Linux, so I would open it up, and I have these /m/rs and this weird stuff, and everything's on one line.
Yeah.
So I had to do this substitution and change them, which wasn't a big deal, but...
Yeah, it's difficult. One of the things on the list here is programmers get really mad when one person is apathetic towards the code base in the project.
Yeah.
I mean, that really can get under your skin. I have a hard time with it because... I'm kind of OCD about certain things, so I have some standards that I think should always be met, and when someone doesn't really think that it should be that, I get really kind of upset because I'm like, just like, why don't you care? Why don't you care? You should. I mean, we should be professionals, and you should care about this. And it's not their fault. It's just a difference of opinion. To them, they're thinking, well, my time is not worth the little bit of quality that would be, you know, that would come of doing this, but All I know is I hate them for it, and it makes me so mad. You know, and it's tough.
The next one we got here is their own code, meaning the programmer's own code 6 months later.
And this is so true. Oh, my goodness.
This one makes me laugh because, like, it's like, you know, you did a web page like 3 years ago, and then you come back in and you're like, God, this guy was an idiot that wrote this, and it was you. You know,
yeah,
you're like,
exactly.
Why'd they do that? Yeah. That's just silly. This is wasting my time. Now I had to rewrite all this stuff. And
the funny part is, I mean, most of this could be limited by all the other things that we talked about. Proper documentation. You know, if you made useful documentation of your own code, you probably wouldn't hate it as much as possible.
Although if you were kind of amateur and you made a lot of weird mistakes, you might still hate yourself.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So a little background for me, when I was a junior in high school, I think, I got hired by my uncle, who was at the time doing a web software business in my hometown. And I mean, I knew absolutely nothing about coding at the time. And he took me under his wing and sort of showed me what he had done. And I remember the day I actually got it. I mean, there was kind of this period of I was replicating what he had written as code and then kind of hacking it until it worked. And I remember the day I got it. I was like, oh, I get it. And all I can think of now is if I saw the code I wrote back then, oh my goodness, that would be so terrible. I just don't think I could live with myself. And the sad part is I'm pretty sure about 50% of the code I wrote back then is still out there in use today.
Oh no.
And I remember that's towards the time before I left there, that was I actually started getting into that mode where I was like, well, I could do it the way it'll work, but I want to do it the way that is right and flexible. And that's a kind of right where I was. And then I went and started college. And so that kind of got thrown out the window because I decided I wasn't going to be a programmer anymore. But yeah, it's looking at your own code later is heart wrenching. I mean, you're just like, oh, I was so silly. And if, I mean, I'm the type of person that I think I'm going to remember everything. I really do. I'm like, how could I forget that? And then, you know, 6 months later, you know, I write some crazy algorithm, some crazy process that, you know, took me forever to think about and figure out. Of course, I'm not going to document it because I'm going to remember it forever. I worked on this for like a week. Of course. How could I forget it?
Yeah.
And 6 months later, no clue at all. Just you're, oh my goodness.
Right. Yeah. Jeez. It's like a table layout or something. It's in HTML. Just like,
yeah.
What was I thinking?
So, you know, the big takeaways are be open-minded, you know, don't be a hypocrite. I think that was the funniest one I thought was that it was like, we hate documenting code. And the next one was we hate code without documentation.
Yeah.
So, you know, be a professional, and, you know, try and get along with other programmers and your management. And, you know, I think if you're open-minded and explain things and act like a professional, all these problems around you should hopefully sort of shake out, but never know. All right, Mark, so what's the next topic we want to talk about today?
Next topic we got here is 8 golden rules of interface design.
Okay, so number one is strive for consistency.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a website, a desktop app, or whatever, try to keep it the same, keep the similar interface. Even if you're going to do like a redesign, try to keep the similar page layout and stuff. Don't change it too much. If you change it too much, sometimes your users will be like, whoa, where's everything at? I was used to this way. I'm just mad.
Yeah, people resist change. It's one of the sort of basic things you learn in any sort of management training at all or class. It's people resist change, and you need to do things to sort of facilitate that change and sort of, you know, lubricate the change process so that people don't feel angry, left out. And the funny part is it doesn't even matter if it's an efficient change. Like if you're like, oh, if we make this change, we can improve efficiency 20%. People hate change. I mean, we just like routines in general.
What was it? WordPress 2.5? The one that
2.7.
Like, changed the theme a lot. People are like, oh, I don't like this. I want to keep the old way. I'm not going to upgrade and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, I mean, it's the things you can do, and I guess we kind of got off topic, but consistency helps lubricate that change. So if you're going to, you know, change the design, try and keep the same menu structure or then, you know, keep sort of maybe the same design and change the menu structure so that people don't have to. So it's not a 100% change. Try and kind of slide into it. You can sort of do that by keeping little chunks of consistency throughout your sort of change morphs throughout the time.
The second one is enable frequent users to use shortcuts. And they give the example of like Gmail, Yahoo, email giving, you know, like the power users shortcuts so they can navigate quickly. And...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I mean, you and I are, I'm a keyboard fanatic. I hate the mouse personally. And so if you can give me shortcuts to do it, especially if it's an app I like you said, Gmail is a great one. I'll learn Gmail stuff until I'm blue in the face because I think it's great.
Also, another kind of a tip about interface design is like if it's a shortcut or a usability thing that people kind of forget they're even using it. Like if they go to another, interface that doesn't have that particular thing, and they're like, "Whoa, where'd it go?" And then they realize, "Man, I didn't realize how much I use that feature." That is a perfect implementation. That was like that. Like so, the scroll mouse. Like yeah. If you've ever gone to a computer that doesn't have one, you're like, "What's going on? Oh, I don't know. Man. I don't even know how to use this computer." That's like proof that is a great shortcut or a great interface
feature. Yeah, you're like, because yeah, exactly. And especially like we said, you and I, we try and learn things very vanilla because we don't like change. So if something is good and consistent around long enough that, like you said, I do the same thing, like, where is this? Because I hate that. That's why I keep things vanilla and standard as possible, because I hate that sort of like, where is it feeling. It drives me nuts. So, I mean, that's so hopefully your user should never have to go through that.
Right.
Because you should keep it consistent.
If the user forgets about it and they're just liking it, then that's the best way. Number three is offer informative feedback.
Yeah, this is sort of like the little thing they talk about here in the article is that, and you see it a lot sometimes, people do bad stuff where if you click something, something doesn't happen. So we use Laconica at work, which is a microblogging platform, and somehow we were hacking with it. And we screwed it up so that when you type in your tweet at the top or whatever and hit submit, it doesn't clear it out. Hmm. And it's really wreaking havoc with our minds because it's driving us nuts because we'll type it and we'll hit like submit and nothing happens. And we know it happens. I mean, it works. It just doesn't clear it out and give us any feedback that it happened. And so like we're always like, did... And then it's so, like we'll like, hit submit again and like refresh and there's like two of them and it just drives us nuts. So, you know, if... you know, the web has sort of a perfect feedback mechanism for a lot of things if you're not doing Ajax. If you click on a page, you see it start loading the new page. That's your feedback. Like, I clicked, I see something is happening. So you have to be really careful with things like Ajax because we need that same sort of feedback mechanism on things that aren't actually loading the whole new page. So like Dig, you know, you click on it and it does like the, Dig, and then grays it out. You know, like, okay, it did something. I know it did something. I feel good about that.
That's a good point.
Number four is walk users through more complicated tasks.
Yeah, like these are like wizards or like even like a shopping cart. They have the steps you have to go through, or maybe it's a form you have to fill out or whatever. Yeah, definitely help them out.
This is like when it's good to have a naive user or someone that hasn't seen your stuff. When you're programming or working on a project, I mean, you know it inside out, and it seems completely intuitive to you because you've been working on it for so long. But it's not intuitive to everyone else. I have a really big problem with this because everything on the web, I mean, I've done so much stuff on the web. I've been on the web so long. It seems 100% intuitive to me, and it's not to other users like some of my coworkers, you know, or my parents, you know, my mom. You know, I signed my dad up for a WordPress, or I gave my dad a WordPress blog, and, you know, I didn't really give him a tour or help him out at all, and he was like, "Well, I'm kind of trying to do this." And I was like, "Well, you just click, you know, post and then add new." And he's like, oh, you can click on the thing and it'll, you know, bring it down. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, like programmers are like the worst people to use for testing integration and,
yeah, exactly,
user interfaces. Get somebody that's not, get a varying user group. Somebody that's beginner, someone's intermediate, and someone that is advanced that's going to use the shortcuts and things.
Yeah.
And then test the three different levels.
Exactly, because it just seems so normal to you. I mean,
yeah, a lot of times the programmers they filled out the form 25 different times. They've already know
exactly.
So they don't test the intricate details.
Yeah,
they don't. You know,
or it seems simple, and it's true. Not to the other person because you know they don't know everything that you know. So yes, definitely try and get different user groups and try and do some usability testing. It's, you know, when you're if you're a smaller company or something, you can try and ask your family, like, "Hey, check this out." You know, like my mom would be a good person to test stuff with because she just is not a power web user. you know, and I design pretty much everything for the way I think, which is a power web user.
The next one here we got, offer simple error handling. So instead of just like spitting out some cryptic error, you should probably maybe go, first of all, say what the error is, and then even go as far as to say maybe how to rectify the error.
Yeah. If it's something they can do.
Right.
Again, if it's just a programming mess up, then maybe you should not spit out an error at all, but just say like, hey, something happened. It's been reported to our team. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I can't remember what program it is, but if you try to run it as like a normal user in Linux, it's like, are you sure you're not root? Are you sure you didn't mean to type it, you know, sudo?
Yeah, exactly.
We can't run without this.
Yeah.
So it kind of helps you. So like a new user might just type it in and expect it to work.
Again, a complicated error or the way you say the error might make sense to you because you're a power user or you've been doing this project for so long, you know it in and out. But look at these people that haven't. I mean, someone who, you know, some people, I know people that get scared when they see like really cryptic error messages, like actual coding errors. They're like, oh my God, I broke it.
Illegal operation.
Yeah. And you're like, oh God, the cops are coming. It's an illegal operation. But you need to, you know, recognize that you're not going to be the one that's getting the error all the time.
I like this one. Permit easy reversal of actions. I know Gmail does this really good. If you accidentally delete an email, they got it right at the very top and notification says undo this, you know, deletion. You know, obviously everyone's familiar with the control Z. In most applications, that's usually like the undo.
You absolutely have to be aware of the back button when you're writing an application. So if you're doing a lot of post variable sending, it doesn't work as well with the back. Only do it when absolutely necessary. Try and do stuff with sessions or cookies or get variables because I hate it. I use the back button naturally. I mean, I have alt back. It's in my repertoire of keyboard shortcuts. And when that doesn't work, I get really teed off because and the funny part is programmers don't seem to realize this, but that's built into every browser. So people are going to use it. I mean, you have to realize that. Sometimes they're like, oh, no one uses that. Well, it's in every single browser on the internet. So people are going to use it. You have to be ready for that.
Yep. Number 7 is make the user feel in control. I mean, this is kind of stuff like, you know, being able to move the window over like iGoogle's, being able to customize things, give them control over a little bit.
I think one great way that we talk about a lot to do this is to feedback systems like get satisfaction.
Oh, yeah, okay.
If people feel like they're, or if Twitter does this, it brings you closer to the development team. People feel like they're making a difference. If you contact a company or something and you email it and you get like that handy little robot automated reply, you're like, well, that's bunk. They don't even care. But something like Twitter, if you can reply a company and they reply back like, you know, thanks for the feedback. I mean, you and I try this a lot. We're like, you know, tweet out ideas you want us to talk about on the show. And, you know, that's a great way to give users, I mean, even let's say, honestly, if you're very controlling about your system, letting them feel like they're participating in your system, even if, you know, you don't end up implementing their suggestions, they feel like they're part of a community that's contributing toward a goal.
Yeah.
By the way, this article has, I'm trying not to laugh because it has some of the funniest pictures I've seen in an article. Like, I started laughing because one of the pictures above was these two dogs in a tub after they got a bath, and they just look absolutely pathetic. So I'm trying not to stare at the pictures the whole time we're recording because they are pretty hilarious.
The one, they've got a security camera, but it's blocked and by exit sign or something.
It's like plan ahead. All right, number 8. Keep it simple. This is great because it is, I mean, like we said, we envision these complex systems in our head. We think everyone can understand it. The average user does not. They can't understand it or they don't want to. They don't really care.
I would add another one too is test and refine. Use things like we talked about last week, Clixby, and find out what your users are doing and see if you could make maybe the process better.
Yeah.
Maybe it's by making it simple like the suggestion, or maybe it's, you know, something that you're missing, and just watch what they're doing and fix it.
Yeah, and I mean, with user interfaces, especially with Univis, you need to keep it clear. You need to keep it clear where they need to go next, what the next step is, what's going to happen. I mean, you've seen like people, especially with Visual Basic, they just get crazy with the user interface. There's radio buttons everywhere. You know, I mean, I've seen some of these ridiculous Visual Basic Windows programs, and they're just not clear at all as to where you need to go next and what you need to do. And it's kind of frustrating because you're like,
All right. Well, that about wraps it up.
That does. That about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind everybody you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. Or you can also leave feedback to the show through all kinds of various methods we have by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
See you.